This is the University of Cambridge Local Examination Syndicate, International General Certificate of Secondary Education, November 2003 examination in English as a second language. Paper 4, Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, center number, and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you are doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the tape back on. Now you are all ready, here is the test. Look at the questions for part one. There are 6 questions in this part of the exam. You will hear each question twice. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. Part 1. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. Atlanta needs to order some books for college. How long will it take, and what is the delivery cost?
I need to order some books for my college courses. How long will it take to order them, please?
3 working days.
Could you deliver them to me?
Yes, but there is a delivery charge of $3.80 in addition to the book price.
I need to order some books for my college courses. How long will it take to order them, please?
3 working days.
Could you deliver them to me?
Yes, but there is a delivery charge of $3.80 in addition to the book price. Question 2. You are organizing a group visit to a youth hostel. How many participants will there be?
Hello, is that the youth hostel? I'm trying to organise a group visit to you in December. There are 36 of us, plus the coach driver, and we would like to stay for 3 nights, with breakfast and dinner included, if possible. Hello, is that the youth hostel? I'm trying to organise a group visit to you in December. There are 36 of us, plus the coach driver, and we would like to stay for 3 nights, with breakfast and dinner included, if possible.
Question 3. Why is your train delayed?
Attention, Platform 8. The Athens Express has been delayed by 90 minutes. This is due to problems with the engine. We will keep you up to date with new expected arrival and departure times. Attention, Platform 8. The Athens Express has been delayed by 90 minutes. This is due to problems with the engine. We will keep you up to date with new expected arrival and departure times.
Question 4. Satya has toothache. How long will it be before she can see the dentist?
Hello. Would it be possible to make an appointment with the dentist? I have bad toothache. I think my tooth is broken.
Do you live very far away? The dentist could see you in 15 minutes from now, if you can get here in that short amount of time.
Yes, please. I'm on my way. Hello? Would it be possible to make an appointment with the dentist? I have bad toothache. I think my tooth is broken.
Do you live very far away? The dentist could see you in 15 minutes from now, if you can get here in that short amount of time.
Yes, please. I'm on my way.
Question 5. Gabor's youth group is going trampolining. What problem arises, and how does Gabor solve it?
Is everyone here and ready? And are you all wearing suitable loose clothing ready for trampolining? Unfortunately, we will have to travel to the leisure centre in 2 consecutive carloads, as we don't have enough cars available to transport you all.
Wait a minute.
Yes, Gabor?
My father will help. Our car seats 8 people.
Is everyone here and ready? And are you all wearing suitable loose clothing ready for trampolining? Unfortunately, we will have to travel to the leisure centre in 2 consecutive carloads, as we don't have enough cars available to transport you all.
Wait a minute.
Yes, Gabor?
My father will help. Our car seats 8 people.
Question 6. Ramon's family is gathering the fruit from both their trees in the garden. How much does each yield?
Here's some more cherries. Must make that up to 40 kilograms in total from that tree.
Yes, and here are the rest of the plums. We have 37 kilograms of them.
Here's some more cherries. Must make that up to 40 kilograms in total from that tree.
Yes, and here are the rest of the plums. We have 37 kilograms of them.
That is the last question in part 1. In a moment, you will hear part 2. Now look at the questions for part 2, exercise 1. Part 2, exercise 1. Question 7. Listen to the following interview about a new dinosaur museum and then complete the notes below. You will hear the interview twice.
Today, we're going on a tour of a brand new dinosaur museum. This exhibition has aroused much public interest, and the huge queues outside the entrance of this exciting attraction are evidence of obvious enthusiasm for dinosaurs. Magnus Mund is the curator of the new exhibition, and he's going to guide us today.
Welcome to Dinosaur Island. Did you notice that our building is actually shaped like a giant dinosaur?
Yes, it's causing much excitement outside. Has this area always been famous for dinosaurs and fossils?
It certainly has. After you have visited the museum, you must walk out onto the beach just before low tide and look for dinosaur footprints. Our guide will take you there and show you some.
What? Real dinosaur footprints? In the water?
Well, in the mud. You'll clearly see 3 toes. The footprints are actually from a young iguanodon and were imprinted in the mud 120 million years ago. There are some fossilized trees lying nearby. They're not quite so old. They're a mere 115 million years old. They don't look like trees at first glance, of course. They're more like pillars sawn into sections and lying on their sides. But if you hold back the seaweed which covers them, you'll be able to see their bark and tree rings.
We'll look forward to seeing all that. What's in the museum, then?
Our introductory section has explanations and displays of fossils from the Ice Age onwards. The next section has live dinosaur models.
Oh, I wondered what the snarling and roaring in the background was.
Yes, it's very dark and noisy in there. Then we have the interactive displays. You can pick up real fossilized dinosaur bones, for example. I don't suppose you've ever done that before.
No, I can't say that I have.
Of course, the whole aim of our museum is to inform people while being fun and educational for all ages at the same time.
Lovely. I'm really looking forward to seeing it all, and especially finding footprints on the beach. Thank you very much. Let's go.
But the best bit is yet to come. There are always new fossils to be found on the beach, and the cliffs are constantly crumbling. If you find a bit of dinosaur bone or whatever, our guide will identify it and date it for you, and then you can take it home to remind you of your visit. All details about the museum, our entrance costs, opening times, facilities, special courses in fossil identification and family fossil hunt days, are available on our website. It's www.dinosaurisland.com.
Thank you for all the information.
No, you're welcome. I hope you really enjoy your visit and that you learn a lot about dinosaurs from it. That's our aim.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Today, we're going on a tour of a brand new dinosaur museum. This exhibition has aroused much public interest, and the huge queues outside the entrance of this exciting attraction are evidence of obvious enthusiasm for dinosaurs. Magnus Mund is the curator of the new exhibition, and he's going to guide us today.
Welcome to Dinosaur Island. Did you notice that our building is actually shaped like a giant dinosaur?
Yes, it's causing much excitement outside. Has this area always been famous for dinosaurs and fossils?
It certainly has. After you have visited the museum, you must walk out onto the beach just before low tide and look for dinosaur footprints. Our guide will take you there and show you some.
What? Real dinosaur footprints? In the water?
Well, in the mud. You'll clearly see three toes. The footprints are actually from a young iguanodon and were imprinted in the mud 120 million years ago. There are some fossilized trees lying nearby. They're not quite so old. They're a mere 115 million years old. They don't look like trees at first glance, of course. They're more like pillars sawn into sections and lying on their sides. But if you hold back the seaweed which covers them, you'll be able to see their bark and tree rings.
We'll look forward to seeing all that. What's in the museum, then?
Our introductory section has explanations and displays of fossils from the Ice Age onwards. The next section has live dinosaur models.
Oh, I wondered what the snarling and roaring in the background was.
Yes, it's very dark and noisy in there. Then we have the interactive displays. You can pick up real fossilized dinosaur bones, for example. I don't suppose you've ever done that before.
No, I can't say that I have.
Of course, the whole aim of our museum is to inform people while being fun and educational for all ages at the same time.
Lovely. I'm really looking forward to seeing it all, and especially finding footprints on the beach. Thank you very much. Let's go.
But the best bit is yet to come. There are always new fossils to be found on the beach, and the cliffs are constantly crumbling. If you find a bit of dinosaur bone or whatever, our guide will identify it and date it for you, and then you can take it home to remind you of your visit. All details about the museum, our entrance costs, opening times, facilities, special courses in fossil identification and family fossil hunt days, are available on our website. It's www.dinosaurisland.com.
Thank you for all the information.
No, you're welcome. I hope you really enjoy your visit and that you learn a lot about dinosaurs from it. That's our aim.
That is the end of Part 2, Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Part 2, Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Part 2, Exercise 2. Question 8. Listen to the following interview with a sports photographer and then complete the notes below. You will hear the interview twice.
Good evening and welcome to Careers with Challenge, our occasional series where we interview people who have interesting but risky or difficult jobs which they enjoy and are successful in carrying out. Tonight we are going to meet 43-year-old Kit Evans, a brave sports photographer who specialises in sailing. Kit, welcome to our programme. Could you tell us about yourself and your challenging career, please?
Yes, I'll tell you about my background first, so that you understand my inspiration and my passion for photography. When I was 5, my father, who was a pilot at the time, gave me a little pocket camera, easy enough for a young child to use. I took it everywhere with me, and I used it. When I was 16, though, I discovered that my school had a darkroom, a room used for developing film, and that it hadn't been used for years because nobody knew how. So I took over the room, set up everything and got the equipment working, and I've never looked back.
So what did you photograph then?
Anything and everything. But gradually I narrowed my range to sports such as rugby, soccer, polo, tennis, windsurfing and gliding. I've also photographed Formula One car racing. In fact, I was nearly run over by one of the cars which skidded towards me as I was photographing it.
So it's quite dangerous being a sports photographer.
Really, it's as dangerous as you make it. Gradually, I became known more as a sailing photographer, with a difference.
What do you mean?
My first assignment in this type of sport was to cover a famous transatlantic race. One of the crew advised me that the best photographs could be taken from the top of the yacht's 28-metre mast.
Is that what you did? Climbed up a mast to take photographs on a rough sea in the middle of the ocean?
I certainly did, and have done so on all my sailing assignments ever since. The pictures taken from the top of a boat's mast are the best.
What happens if the boat capsizes, though?
Well, obviously, I have a sort of harness to keep me tied to the mast, but that can be a disadvantage when you're trying to escape being pulled under a capsizing yacht. This really did happen to me once. I was being filmed for a program about a boat show. Suddenly, the crew lost control and the boat started to capsize. I kept taking photos until I hit the water. I was still attached to the mast, but was able to free myself on that occasion.
What a risky career.
It is, but that's what I choose to do. I love to be there in the middle of the action, jumping, crouching, climbing, diving, or swinging on ropes. I like to work against the situation and the elements, the tide, the wind, and the rain, to get a unique shot. The greatest challenge in my job is to see the action before it happens and to capture it. If you see the action as it happens, it's too late and you miss the shot. You have to anticipate it. There's no second chance.
You leave us feeling worn out just thinking about what you do. Where can we see your pictures, the fruit of the risks you take?
In my book, just published. It's available from all good bookshops. I hope you enjoy it. That's what I work for. My book is called Sailing in Action. If you would like to order it from the bookshop, give the reference 015-143-506-Y.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Good evening, and welcome to Careers with Challenge, our occasional series where we interview people who have interesting but risky or difficult jobs which they enjoy and are successful in carrying out. Tonight we are going to meet 43-year-old Kit Evans, a brave sports photographer who specialises in sailing. Kit, welcome to our programme. Could you tell us about yourself and your challenging career, please?
Yes, I'll tell you about my background first, so that you understand my inspiration and my passion for photography. When I was 5, my father, who was a pilot at the time, gave me a little pocket camera, easy enough for a young child to use. I took it everywhere with me, and I used it. When I was 16, though, I discovered that my school had a dark room, a room used for developing film, and that it hadn't been used for years because nobody knew how. So I took over the room, set up everything and got the equipment working, and I've never looked back.
So what did you photograph then?
Anything and everything. But gradually I narrowed my range to sports such as rugby, soccer, polo, tennis, windsurfing and gliding. I've also photographed Formula One car racing. In fact, I was nearly run over by one of the cars which skidded towards me as I was photographing it.
So it's quite dangerous being a sports photographer.
Really, it's as dangerous as you make it. Gradually, I became known more as a sailing photographer, with a difference.
What do you mean?
My first assignment in this type of sport was to cover a famous transatlantic race. One of the crew advised me that the best photographs could be taken from the top of the yacht's 28-metre mast.
Is that what you did? Climbed up a mast to take photographs on a rough sea in the middle of the ocean?
I certainly did, and have done so on all my sailing assignments ever since. The pictures taken from the top of a boat's mast are the best.
What happens if the boat capsizes, though?
Well, obviously, I have a sort of harness to keep me tied to the mast. But that can be a disadvantage when you're trying to escape being pulled under a capsizing yacht. This really did happen to me once. I was being filmed for a program about a boat show. Suddenly, the crew lost control and the boat started to capsize. I kept taking photos until I hit the water. I was still attached to the mast, but was able to free myself on that occasion.
What a risky career.
It is, but that's what I choose to do. I love to be there in the middle of the action, jumping, crouching, climbing, diving, or swinging on ropes. I like to work against the situation and the elements, the tide, the wind and the rain, to get a unique shot. The greatest challenge in my job is to see the action before it happens and to capture it. If you see the action as it happens, it's too late and you miss the shot. You have to anticipate it. There's no second chance.
You leave us feeling worn out just thinking about what you do. Where can we see your pictures, the fruit of the risks you take?
In my book, just published. It's available from all good bookshops. I hope you enjoy it. That's what I work for. My book is called Sailing in Action. If you would like to order it from the bookshop, give the reference 015-143-506-Y.
That is the end of part two. In a moment, you will hear part three. Now look at the questions for part three, exercise one. Part three. Part three, exercise one. Question nine. Listen to the following interview about disappearing forests and then answer the questions below. You will hear the interview twice.
Today on Nature Trail, we find out about a new report which warns us that the world's forests are disappearing. Dr. Daniel Wells, a well-known environmentalist, is here in the studio with us. Daniel, could you tell us about this report?
Yes, certainly. Basically, satellite pictures have shown us that the world's main woodlands, more than 80% of total forests, are concentrated in only 15 countries.
So what exactly did these satellite pictures show you?
They provided a clear picture of the total forest cover around Earth's globe. You see, all the previous studies giving us similar warnings about disappearing forests were based on statistics provided by individual countries. The satellite picture provides a view of the whole of Earth at once and provides a means of comparison between forested areas.
So the new pictures show that the situation is worse than you feared?
Oh, much worse. Huge areas of forests have been cleared in the last 50 years, and I'm sure this will continue in future years despite our warnings.
So how can we prevent the further disappearance of forests?
Well, the only way to reverse the process is to transform the attitude of people and governments. Otherwise, the remaining closed canopy forests and all the wildlife which is associated with them could soon disappear.
What is a closed canopy forest?
A forest in which trees cover more than 40% of the land. The biggest of these are in Siberia and Canada, because the population densities there are low.
So if the forests disappear, so does their wildlife.
The importance of healthy forest is huge. Forests are vital for the well-being of our planet.
Can you give us some examples?
Yes. Forests regulate the quality and quantity of rainwater being discharged into rivers. They counter soil erosion and stop deserts from spreading too far over the surface of the earth.
They soak up the carbon from the air too, don't they?
Yes. And of course they give refuge to much endangered wildlife. The elephant in Africa, the orangutan in Indonesia, Siberian tigers in Siberia, and the giant panda in China, to name but a few.
All these breeds would disappear. How dreadful.
Do you begin to see the importance of retaining our forests now?
Absolutely. Surely forests must provide food for local people too.
Yes, food and, of course, medicines. So we need an educational program so that those using forests in order to make a living, those who provide wood to the paper industry, for example, see their value as sustainable resources, and we must give these people an alternative means of income rather than the exploitation of disappearing forests.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Today on Nature Trail, we find out about a new report which warns us that the world's forests are disappearing. Dr. Daniel Wells, a well-known environmentalist, is here in the studio with us. Daniel, could you tell us about this report?
Yes, certainly. Basically, satellite pictures have shown us that the world's main woodlands, more than 80% of total forests, are concentrated in only 15 countries.
So what exactly did these satellite pictures show you?
They provided a clear picture of the total forest cover around Earth's globe. You see, all the previous studies giving us similar warnings about disappearing forests were based on statistics provided by individual countries. The satellite picture provides a view of the whole of Earth at once and provides a means of comparison between forested areas.
So the new pictures show that the situation is worse than you feared?
Oh, much worse. Huge areas of forests have been cleared in the last 50 years, and I'm sure this will continue in future years despite our warnings.
So how can we prevent the further disappearance of forests?
Well, the only way to reverse the process is to transform the attitude of people and governments. Otherwise, the remaining closed canopy forests and all the wildlife which is associated with them could soon disappear.
What is a closed canopy forest?
a forest in which trees cover more than 40% of the land. The biggest of these are in Siberia and Canada, because the population densities there are low.
So if the forests disappear, so does their wildlife.
The importance of healthy forest is huge. Forests are vital for the well-being of our planet.
Can you give us some examples?
Yes. Forests regulate the quality and quantity of rainwater being discharged into rivers. They counter soil erosion and stop deserts from spreading too far over the surface of the earth.
They soak up the carbon from the air too, don't they?
Yes. And of course they give refuge to much endangered wildlife. The elephant in Africa, the orangutan in Indonesia, Siberian tigers in Siberia, and the giant panda in China, to name but a few.
All these breeds would disappear. How dreadful.
Do you begin to see the importance of retaining our forests now?
Absolutely. Surely forests must provide food for local people too.
Yes, food and, of course, medicines. So we need an educational program so that those using forests in order to make a living, those who provide wood to the paper industry, for example, see their value as sustainable resources, and we must give these people an alternative means of income rather than the exploitation of disappearing forests.
That is the end of Part 3, Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Part 3, Exercise 2, Question 10. Listen to the following interview about using wind power as an alternative energy source, then answer the questions below. You will hear the interview twice.
Huge modern wind structures use wind power as an alternative energy source. They're usually situated on remote mountain ranges or far out to sea in offshore wind farms. Nowadays, however, wind power is becoming increasingly common in cities as well as in the countryside. Here is Professor Thomas Georgios, a wind turbine engineering expert, to tell us more.
Wind power can be used everywhere and is becoming increasingly popular as an alternative means of providing electricity. We're drawing up plans to put wind turbines in all sorts of places. Wind turbines are sort of modern windmills, tall structures up to 105 meters high with a rotor blade at the pinnacle. We've had inquiries for turbines to be built on office block rooftops in the middle of cities, in car parks, and in back gardens of suburban houses. We plan to create mini wind farms in selected areas of cities in order to provide electricity for those places.
Really? What are the benefits of wind power then? Obviously, it saves using fossil fuels.
Wind power is the fastest growing energy form in Great Britain, for example, and by 2005 should be able to supply 1.6% of the nation's electricity.
Well, that's good. Will that percentage rise?
It has to. By 2010, 10% of national power has to be supplied by renewable sources.
Are there many wind turbines in use at the moment?
857 turbines in 67 farms to date, 100 to be added within 12 months, and 541 to be added within 4 years in 18 new offshore wind farms. Also, each week, many people decide to erect a turbine in their garden. For this purpose, we install smaller turbines, only 10 to 15 meters tall. Some private companies are also starting to use this renewable form of power.
Wind power is a brilliant idea, but why the sudden interest?
Because companies are soon to be taxed on any electricity produced from fossil fuels.
So what can wind turbines be used for?
There are many purposes, both large and small. In one city, for example, two small turbines on top of a set of traffic lights power a mini generator and provide the electricity for the lights.
Don't birds fly into the whirring blades?
Not often, but it's important to situate turbines away from migration routes.
Do you think it would be noisy to have a wind turbine in your back garden or outside your office or shop window?
No. All you would hear would be a soft swishing of the blades. You would soon get used to it. Besides, it's a small price to pay for the advantage of providing electricity from renewable resources.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Huge modern wind structures use wind power as an alternative energy source. They're usually situated on remote mountain ranges or far out to sea in offshore wind farms. Nowadays, however, wind power is becoming increasingly common in cities as well as in the countryside. Here is Professor Thomas Georgios, a wind turbine engineering expert, to tell us more.
Wind power can be used everywhere and is becoming increasingly popular as an alternative means of providing electricity. We're drawing up plans to put wind turbines in all sorts of places. Wind turbines are sort of modern windmills, tall structures up to 105 meters high with a rotor blade at the pinnacle. We've had inquiries for turbines to be built on office block rooftops in the middle of cities, in car parks, and in back gardens of suburban houses. We plan to create mini wind farms in selected areas of cities in order to provide electricity for those places.
Really? What are the benefits of wind power then? Obviously, it saves using fossil fuels.
Wind power is the fastest growing energy form in Great Britain, for example, and by 2005 should be able to supply 1.6% of the nation's electricity.
Well, that's good. Will that percentage rise?
It has to. By 2010, 10% of national power has to be supplied by renewable sources.
Are there many wind turbines in use at the moment?
857 turbines in 67 farms to date, 100 to be added within 12 months, and 541 to be added within 4 years in 18 new offshore wind farms. Also, each week, many people decide to erect a turbine in their garden. For this purpose, we install smaller turbines, only 10 to 15 meters tall. Some private companies are also starting to use this renewable form of power.
Wind power is a brilliant idea, but why the sudden interest?
Because companies are soon to be taxed on any electricity produced from fossil fuels.
So what can wind turbines be used for?
There are many purposes, both large and small. In one city, for example, two small turbines on top of a set of traffic lights power a mini generator and provide the electricity for the lights.
Don't birds fly into the whirring blades?
Not often, but it's important to situate turbines away from migration routes.
Do you think it would be noisy to have a wind turbine in your back garden or outside your office or shop window?
No. All you would hear would be a soft swishing of the blades. You would soon get used to it. Besides, it's a small price to pay for the advantage of providing electricity from renewable resources.
That is the end of part three and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will stop the tape and collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, center number, and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, the tape should now be stopped and all the papers collected. Thank you, everyone.